Before we dive into today's incredible episode, I wanted to remind you that enrollment to Write Well, my women's writing community, is closing at the end of October. In that community with the women writers that I teach, we gather together every single Monday for MFA level craft talks and writing time and sharing. And the women in that community have supported each other so much to achieve their writing goals. And achieve, they have. They've published countless books and hundreds of articles and essays in major magazines. It is a fabulous group of women and they are so supportive. We would love for you to join us. You can check out more in the link in my show notes. And if you want to see what all the magic is about, you can even download a replay of a recent class and see if it's the right fit for you. Remember, doors close at the end of October. All the links are in the show notes.
Life is full of contradictions. Most of the things we love, we also have reservations about. Aging, living in New York City.
This is Heart of the Story, and I'm Nadine Kenny Johnstone. I'm an author and a holistic writing coach who talks with today's top women writers about how to navigate life when things don't go according to plan. These impactful conversations and personal reflections invite you to be seen, feel supported, and ultimately fall back in love with yourself. So let's go together to that honest, powerful place, the heart of the story. Oh, friends, if you are anything like me, you are fascinated and puzzled by age. There are times when I feel like I was born yesterday, and there are other times where I feel absolutely ancient. And today's guest has a similar fascination. Today we are speaking with Sari Botten. She is the creator of Oldster magazine, where she interviews different writers and creatives about age, and in particular, what it's like to, as she says, travel through time in a human body at every phase of life. Ooh, and this is particularly fitting because Sari just turned 60. Happy birthday, Sari. So in her honor, I wanted to bring back this conversation where we talk about many things. Not only what she has learned about life and aging from the people she's interviewed on Oldster, but also what her plans are for her 60s and beyond, and some unexpected life events that have made her feel the urgency of time. This conversation was an absolute delight, and I can't wait for you to listen. Sari Botten, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
I like to start off often just asking people in general about their current season of life, just to get us grounded. Where are you at in your current season of life? What does that look like for you?
Funny you should ask. yesterday I turned 59. I don't know if you know this, but 59 comes before 60. And 60 is a number that is freaking me out in a way that no number has freaked me out since 30. So I'm thinking a lot about entering my 60s. I mean, technically, I've begun my 60th year. You turn 59, you've completed 59 years, and you are beginning your 60th year. Oh, yeah. So I am beginning my 60th year. I'm beginning what many consider the third act of life. You know, if you divide life into 1 to 30, 30 to 60, and 60 to 90, if you're lucky to live that long, I'm entering my third act. So I am very much thinking about what it means, what I want to achieve and attain, and, you know, how to do this all with grace and minimal pain. I say this as a person with very bad arthritis. But also someone who has just watched The Substance, a body horror movie about aging and the things people do to mitigate their aging. Mm. So I'm really, really thinking about what aging entails throughout life.
Yeah. I loved your post about that on Oldster, where you talked about turning 59 and everything that you're thinking about in regards to that time. And so what are some of these big dreams and plans that you have for the next act?
Well, I'd like to take some creative leaps I haven't yet taken. I'd like to write more books, but I also would, you know, I have these ideas about movies. I have a documentary I want to make about why women are afraid to sing publicly or embarrassed by it. It's something I've been thinking about my entire life. You know, I have a lot of wishes and dreams. I don't know how practical any of them are. I want to have a podcast. You have a podcast. I'd like to have like a real professional podcast. I'd like to do an Oldster anthology, but I'd also like to travel more. You know, there's a lot I haven't done in my life. I don't come from money, so I have to like really strive for a lot of what I get and do. I haven't ever been very well connected, you know, so everything I do comes out of a lot of work, a lot of uphill battle. And so I'm also looking forward to prioritizing, like I can't just willy-nilly try everything that crosses my mind. You know, mm-hmm. I'm going to slow down eventually. And, you know, aging is a privilege, but it also brings challenges with it and limited time. So I'm going to have to be selective about what I go forward with.
Mm. So all this talk about age and phases of life brings me to Oldster, which I think the joy of that, why I love reading it so much, is that on it, we get to, as readers, see this questionnaire that you pose to all of the people who come on and take the questionnaire. And there are ordinary people, there are very well-known people, all different ages, all different backgrounds. That's really the beauty of it. I love being able to see how different people experience different phases of life. And as you were dreaming up Oldster, I would love to first kind of know the impetus and how you were able to really hone in on the idea for it.
Well, the impetus came from knowing I wasn't done with something I had started at Longreads. I was an editor at Longreads for 5 years. And while I was there, I had launched a series called Fine Lines, which was personal essays about the experience of getting older at every phase of life. And it was all genders. And I was really enjoying working on it. And then I left Longreads in June of 2020. I knew I wasn't done with the subject. I wasn't sure how to tackle it. I needed a new title because Longreads owned that title. And then one morning in August of 2021, I awoke from a dream in which I had started a magazine called Oldster, which I thought was hilarious. And I went on Twitter to make a joke about it. And then I realized, oh, actually, that's kind of cool. It's like a title that had once been a slur that I could kind of turn on its head and play with. So that very morning, August 31st, 2021, I went on Substack and started Oldster, and it immediately took off. But it wasn't a new obsession for me. It was something I'd been thinking about since I was 10 years old, when my uncle came to my 10-year-old birthday party and told me, oh, you'll never be one digit again. And I was like, what? You mean I've crossed through a portal and I can't go back the other way? How many other portals are there like this? And what does it mean? And I'm not ready for this. And should I be ready for this? And I applied that lens to every milestone in my life from the time I was 10. And so, but then in my 50s, I started to experience age discrimination and terrible arthritis and my hair graying and falling out. And I was like, okay, now this has deeper meaning to me. And so I need to delve into it. And I love to to collect voices around a subject. And that's mm-hmm. what I did with my New York City anthologies, Goodbye to All That and Never Can Say Goodbye. I love to ask other people, what's your experience of this thing I'm going through or this thing that I went through? I love to find out what other people think and feel about these things, partly because I'm insecure about my own experience. Like, am I having the right feeling? Mm. You know, I've always been a little bit different from everyone around me. And so self-conscious that maybe I'm having the wrong feelings or maybe the wrong approach. So I love to try and find consensus. And of course, there's never consensus. Everyone, well, there are certain things that reappear and reappear, but there are also very different experiences reported. And I love that too. I love entertaining other people's experiences and ideas.
So as you have been gathering these different experiences, there's this moment of hoping for validation of like, am I experiencing the world that other people are? There's something about that that's so interesting. But also, like you said, it comes back and it turns out people are having all these different experiences. What does that do for you? So what are some of the things that have struck you as you've been gathering all of these oldster questionnaires? What are you learning about age and about being human?
I'm learning so much. You know, I ask people in the Oldster magazine questionnaire the questions I'm dying to know. Like, my curiosity is all over this project. And I just yesterday added 5 questions and I answered those questions. And I'm learning that people are thinking about aging and what it means. You know, other people are trying to understand what they're being older now or getting older or being younger than this person or older than that person. What does it mean? Does it mean what the culture wants us to believe it means? Does it mean something different? And, you know, there have been some real surprises. For instance, last year on my 58th birthday, I posted also mentioning that I'm anxious about 60. And so many people wrote to me saying, Sari, my life began at 60. Mm. At 60, I was free to explore this or that. My husband died, and then I thought it was the end of the world, but then I went on to discover that I like living alone. Or, you know, I'm just throwing out like examples. Or I retired from my job and it opened up new avenues for me to a new career or new hobbies. Or I finally got to become an author or an actor or a singer. It's really fascinating how many new beginnings people find throughout their lives. And the culture wants us to believe it's over for us in certain ways at certain points in our lives. The culture is still telling us that while it's trying to sell us, you know, antidotes. And so I have been really excited to learn from people that it's not always the way you assume it is.
I think as I read it, there are many things that strike me. One is exactly what you're talking about, that it's never too late, that an age doesn't have to be a closed door ever.
Yes.
Also, some of the other things that have struck me are like models for aging. When I read Cheryl Strayed's questionnaire answers, it got me thinking for some reason about one of her responses, got me thinking about who I look at for my models of how I want to age with integrity, the way that I hope to live, who's living and aging in the way that I want to. And it also has me thinking about some of these really deep questions, like one of the ones you posed in your recent post, those extra 5 about regret. And so that to me, as soon as I saw that word regret, I was pulled in and engaged, because in some ways I feel like if we can read about what other people have regretted at certain points, then maybe we can not have that regret in the end. Maybe we could be doing something right now that will allow us to move through that in a way where we don't have that regret. Like when we talk about 5 regrets of the dying or something, you know, you're like, okay, is there a way that I can avoid that? Probably not. We'll all have regret in some way. But what are the questions that most intrigue you that you said, like, you're so curious about this? This is a fascination. It's an obsession. You're dying to know this.
Well, the second question on the questionnaire is about whether there's an internal age that's different from your chronological age. Mm-hmm. And there has been a lot written about this. In fact, I just got a press release about some study that's been done about it. And The Atlantic had an article about it. It was written by Jennifer Senior, and she quoted me in it. It's a real phenomenon. And I didn't know it was a real phenomenon until I started the Oldster Magazine questionnaire and asked people about it, because I have internal ages that are different from my chronological age. Like when I initially flashed myself in many situations, like my idea of myself, there's a version of me that's 10 and a half. There's a version of me that's like 15 or 16. There's a version of me that's in my early 30s. You know, it depends on the situation, but very often when I flash to myself, there's a much younger version of me in mind. And it's a very common phenomenon. And it seems to be attached to either trauma mm-hmm. or huge changes that took place in your life, good or bad. Mm-hmm. And there's a part of our understanding of ourselves that gets kind of stuck in these spots. Yeah. For me, like my parents divorced when I was 10 and a half. And like, there's a part of me that is really very much anchored there. Mm-hmm. And who she looked like and what her choices were. And my style is still very much like that version of me. Yeah. So there are versions of me attached to those experiences in the past. And the same is true, it turns out, for so many other respondents of the questionnaire. And then when Jennifer Senior was writing about it for The Atlantic, and then this press release, I'm like, okay, I need to follow my curiosity more often, because I'm tapping into something that came out of my mind that other people are thinking about. Mm. I mean, all the questions on the questionnaire are things I'm dying to know. I love the question about whether getting older has changed your self-concept, like how you think of yourself. Just all the questions. They're all things that I'm dying to know. The regret question that I've just added feels really important to me. I'm hoping that it will help people regret less mm-hmm. and realize that other people have similar regrets, and that it's natural in life to do regrettable things and then hopefully learn from them and pivot. Mm-hmm. And also to learn to forgive ourselves, that we're flawed, we're human, and it's natural to make errors and then correct them or, you know, take a different course.
Mm. So since on this podcast, we talk about how to navigate life when things don't go according to plan, I think about the pivot a lot. And I think about self-compassion a lot and forgiveness a lot. I'm always so curious about when we have one idea in our heads of what a certain stage of life is going to look like, and we have a plan, and then life takes a different course. I'm so curious about what happens in that moment for people, because we can either panic, or we could try to backtrack, or we try to control, or we freak out, or we turn to vices. Like, there's so many things that can happen in that moment where expectation and reality disagree. And so what have you found both personally, but in the Oldster responses about how people are navigating, how they pivot? How do you pivot with grace? Is that possible? What has it looked like for you?
My hope is that Oldster magazine will help people do that.
Yeah.
By reading about other people's experiences of pivoting with grace or forgiving themselves. That's the hope. Mm-hmm. But I'm seeing a lot of respondents talk about that. Now and then I'll get respondents who will say things like, I haven't been able to recover from this thing that happened to me.
Yeah.
And that's a real response. And I appreciate that too, because sometimes we can paint a picture that's too rosy, that is not genuine, of like, I moved on and now I'm starting over. You know, it's really hard to do. And sometimes it takes time and healing, and you have to allow for that and to acknowledge that you haven't recovered from something, but that you still hope to, is also quite vulnerable and beautiful. It's very inspiring to read again and again about how people had a devastating experience, thought it was over, or at least that aspect of their life was over. And then life moved on and brought them to a new spot where there were new possibilities. And that is very, very inspiring to me. I'm right now in the wake of two things that happened that I did not expect. Well, one that I kind of expected, but they happened back to back and they just kind of threw me for a loop. One is that my friend died. Now, I knew she was sick. She had breast cancer. She had terminal breast cancer. She was sick for 2.5 years, but she was deceptively well-looking. She was hearty and strong until the very end. And then hospice anticipated she'd be there for a month to 3 months. She made it 8 days. So that threw me for a loop. And then when on my way home from her memorial, when we pulled into the driveway, we discovered that our other car had been plowed into by a driver, a hit and run. So the back-to-back unexpected or unplanned or, you know, what wasn't written into the script that I wanted to have. I didn't want my friend to die and I didn't want my car to be destroyed by a hit and run driver, really just threw me off kilter for several days. I was just not myself. And so I know, you know, it was a good reminder for me that life doesn't always go according to plan and that this stuff happens and that you need to give yourself time to recover from it. And that life sometimes hurts, you know, that we can't just gloss over these things and that there are things to be learned from them, but that you have to have grace. You have to give yourself time. You have to give the experience time to play itself out. And so those moments can be messy. And the best thing to do is to just be present in those moments. I'm learning. And to take time, let everything play itself out, let your feelings catch up. And then be as present as you can so that when the new opportunities show up, when life comes back at you, you're ready for it. You're not still, you know, stuck in resisting what happened.
It makes me think a lot about Liz Gilbert's Letters from Love, about the way that we talk to ourselves. I had been doing a practice for many years. I called it wise woman letters, like a tapping into the wisest part of me to speak to me. And then I loved when Liz Gilbert came out with Letters from Love, because it was just this beautiful way to speak to ourselves. And I know that you wrote a letter for that.
I did. I was just going to send it to you.
Yes. I loved the self-compassion, even in the way you spoke to yourself, Sassafras, right? So what does that look like for you, your own self-compassion practices?
I tend to do too much ruminating on mistakes, regrets.
I don't know anything about that.
And I have to bring myself back to center and remind myself of what brought me to those mistakes, what state I was in, what conditions around me contributed to that, you know, external factors, upbringing, financial background, you know, where I was at that time in my life before I'd learned more. When I do yoga at the end, I try to do a meditation of sending loving kindness to myself, people I love, and also people I don't like. I'm just trying to like make the world a more compassionate place. You know, after some down dog, it's time to like just send out the love. With the people I don't like, it's a fake it till you make it situation. And it has actually helped me bridge gaps with people I don't like. And maybe come to understand them differently. There are some people who I really thought I was just at odds with, who I'm now cordial with. And maybe there's a possibility for, maybe we could be friends. Maybe I misunderstood this person. But anyway, but maybe I also misunderstood myself. And so it's a conscious effort to extend compassion to myself, my younger self, my less experienced self, my less aware self.
It makes me think of the first time I was ever doing a Sharon Salzberg meditation, and she was walking us through loving kindness, and I was going, okay, yeah, this feels so good to give loving kindness to myself and my loved ones. Mm-hmm. And then when we got to the part of and other people that we may not be so fond of, I remember opening my eyes and being like, wait a minute. And then when I did it, I realized, oh, this is why we must do this.
You know, I had a really powerful experience. There was somebody I was sending loving kindness to who I really, really don't like, who had been really hurtful to me.
Yeah.
And about 2 months after I started giving them loving kindness, I received an apology. Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah. And I don't think it's magic. I do have this suspicion that our brains communicate with each other in ways we don't yet understand. Mm-hmm. So I think that's possible. But I also think that if I was thinking, I mean, more rationally, if I am thinking about this incident, this other person must be thinking about it too. Mm-hmm. And if something played out in such a way that it is still sitting in my mind, it's probably still sitting in their mind. And how nice to have someone come to you and say, I was wrong and I apologize.
How healing that is.
Oh, so healing. And it made me feel better that instead of sending daggers to this person, I paused and I said, this is a person who is acting out or has acted out toward me because of whatever they've been through. And so, yeah, let's all do that. I've been thinking a lot lately about beefs people have had with me or I've had with people, thinking about how much misunderstanding there has been because a lot of what we're reading about people is internet posts. Mm-hmm. We're making assumptions about people. Also, old beefs, you know, things that happened years ago, we've all moved on. We've all grown. I was thinking like of writing a post about like, what if we all just reset with everybody? What if we all just started back at zero with everybody? Even our worst, you know, the people in our minds who are our worst enemies. What if we just started at zero again, gave everybody a chance, a new beginning, especially after the pandemic and everything we're all going through now, you know, wars, hurricanes, like, what if we all gave each other grace and started from scratch? And I like that, you know?
I've been thinking about this a lot too. One of my other deep curiosities is how to have lovingly hard conversations. And what I mean by that is in my own therapy work, I've been calling 2024 the year of hard conversations because going from conflict avoidant, I've been trying to have loving conversations with people I truly cherish, where we talk about the hard stuff that we've either swept under the rug or it's like always nagging, but we're not going to talk about that thing. Little things, big hurts, you name it. And I realize I have no script for this. I have no script. I have no template. I truly don't know how to approach it with so much love that the other person feels open when we have these hard talks, how to not put that wall up and get defensive, how to truly, truly hear. We have heard that we need to listen to other people, but how do we truly hear when we're feeling the hurt rise up or the defensiveness? And so I'm fascinated by this topic. And the idea of the reset is really, really beautiful to think about, of how do we start again? How do we start anew without all of those past hurts or recent hurts just clobbering, or our misunderstandings and all of that? Oh, I would love if there was a magic potion for this.
Yeah. One of the things I mentioned in my memoir, I had a very bad experience in eighth grade with Mean Girls. And it affected my ability to form close friendships with women throughout my life. And one of the things I talk about is how I am a truth teller, and sometimes I've gotten myself into trouble being too blunt, too direct, or touching on things that people are too uncomfortable talking about. Mm. And I say, I wish it were normal to have difficult conversations, you know, to address the elephant in the room, to talk about it. I think it would be more productive than just ghosting each other.
Yeah.
In fact, there's a friend I am debating whether to have a difficult conversation with. And I've written an email that I don't know if I'll send. There's something funky between us, and I don't understand what's happening. And I'm trying, but I'm also trying to respect that maybe if this person has put up a wall, they just want privacy and they don't want me to ask what's going on. You know, it's a very fine line to tread. And then there's another person who keeps pursuing me who I really don't want to be friends with. And I wish she would stop trying. I have been polite in my boundary drawing, and she's not taking the cues that I'm sending. And I don't want to have to say, I'm not interested in this, you know? And that's really hard. But maybe it would be a relief for her to hear, oh, she just doesn't want to be friends with me. You know, maybe it would be a relief to hear, you know what? You're barking up the wrong tree. Go put your energy somewhere else. Like maybe that would just stop this dance that I don't want to be part of.
Yeah.
And maybe the other person feels that way about me, but doesn't have the ability to articulate, you know what? You're just not my cup of tea.
Okay.
Well, it's tricky.
Yeah.
It's tricky. And then I also like, who do I want to expend this energy toward? I don't have the energy to, you know, everyone who wants to engage with me in a particular way, who I don't want to engage with. I don't have time to process this with everybody, you know, which are the relationships where it matters. You know, you don't have to process everything with everybody.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. It's where do we put our energy? How do we say it in a way that will kind of free both people, but not hurt? It is tricky territory. And this I am endlessly fascinated by. And it also makes me think of kind of endings and beginnings. It makes me think of the writing that you've done and collected around leaving New York City, but still loving New York City. And as someone who has moved many more times than I ever anticipated and am a Chicagoan who loved Chicago but has left Chicago, I deeply resonate with this love for and distance from something. And I would love if you can kind of walk us through your own experience of leaving New York, but still loving New York and how it has evolved in these anthologies.
It's funny. I'm going tomorrow to the city for 4 nights. Ooh. I'm so excited. Ooh. I miss New York so much. And I'm so sad that it's so expensive and it's not like an option to go there more, stay there more. And so, you know, I'll never be over New York. Mm-hmm. However, I also love where I live. I live in Kingston, New York. I love the Mid-Hudson Valley. I love my community. I love my house. I couldn't have the amount of space I have here in Kingston, in New York City. And luckily I got this, we bought this house as a foreclosure in 2018 before the pandemic had everyone and his brother moving up here. But New York City is like the one that got away. Mm-hmm. And I lived there for about 15 years, mostly in the East Village. I mean, there's no place like New York. And it is such a big bag of contradictions. You know, it is the worst place. It is the best place. Mm-hmm. Always. Mm-hmm. You know, I go in, I visit, and you know, there's rats in the subway, there's garbage stinking up the street. And while I'm there, I'm like, what is wrong with people? Why are they spending this kind of money to live, you know, with garbage accumulating on the streets like this, in buildings that are crumbling? And then while I'm there, I just have such a magnificent time and I don't want to come home. Mm-hmm. It's this magical place that makes no sense and all the sense. Mm-hmm. And I just, I'll never be done with the subject of New York. In fact, I have another newsletter called Memoir Land, and I've added a section called Goodbye to All That, where I've been publishing new and old pieces about New York City and life there. And I mean, life is full of contradictions. Most of the things we love, we also have, you know, reservations about. Yeah. Aging, living in New York City. And the thing about my New York anthologies, Goodbye to All That and Never Can Say Goodbye, is that they're both about the same thing. They're both about the push-pull that New York exerts on its inhabitants, where, mm-hmm. whereby it is just as hard to stay as it is to leave.
Yeah.
For various reasons. It is very hard to maintain your place in New York City. It's also really hard to leave. It's hard to say goodbye to this place.
Mm. I feel like so much of your writing is where you give people space to talk about living in the contradiction, feeling both old and young, loving New York, yes. leaving New York. It is so refreshing to not feel like it has to be one or the other. The first time I read Goodbye to All That, I was like, she's got it. She and the other contributors really kind of peg what it's like to love a place and also have your reservations about a place and leave, but still miss. And it was so refreshing and validating to know that all of those emotions could exist within one space. And I also loved that it was called Goodbye to All That, because I remember the first time I read Joan Didion's essay, I underlined every line yeah. in that freaking essay. There's one, I'm going to paraphrase it, but there's one line about going in the revolving door at 22 and coming out on another street at a different age, an entirely different person. And that's what a place can do to you.
And particularly New York can do that to you. Yeah. You know, some people suggested to me over the years, why don't you do one of those for every major city? And I was like, well, I've never lived in every major city. I don't have the same curiosity about it. And also, like, yeah, places all have their own virtues and magic qualities, but nothing is New York. There's just this is singular.
Mm. And when you collected other people's experiences, first in Goodbye to All That and then Never Say Goodbye, how did that impact you? What did that do for you?
Well, I was doing what I was doing with Oldster, which is trying to find out, like, is everybody else having this experience?
Yes. Yes.
Am I the only one? And then it also, like, opened my eyes to all different aspects of what it means for people to live in New York, for better and for worse. Mm-hmm. You know, I love, as I said earlier, collecting a bunch of voices around a subject, because I love the variety. I love learning that maybe there are people who feel differently about their experiences. Maybe there's more to this than I know. That's my favorite way of doing research on anything.
Well, this question, am I the only one? I mean, I think that's why any of us who is a voracious reader is a voracious reader, because we love reading, but really we're reading to find out that we're not alone, that we're not the only yeah. one, that other people have the same experience. It gives us permission to feel the way we feel. And so I know that in my hardest times, that one of the things I do besides try to give myself self-compassion is I turn to the written word and I try to figure out, has anybody else felt this way and how did they get through it and what can I do? And please tell me I'm not alone, because if I'm already going through something hard and I'm the only one, then oh my gosh, how do I get back from this?
Yeah, we all want to know we're not alone.
Mm-hmm. And you wrote about even like the word weird and thinking about the word weird and all the connotations that that has. I'd love for you to maybe talk a little bit about that and some of the insights that you made as you were exploring weird, weirdo, and what you came to understand.
Well, so the word weirdo is in my title of my memoir. The memoir is called And You May Find Yourself, Confessions of a Late Blooming Gen X Weirdo. And when I was working on the book, I was struggling and I wanted to get the word weirdo tattooed on my arm. I have a number of tattoos and I stopped short and instead went with a typewriter that I've drawn because I just thought it was too alienating to brand myself literally that way. But I have felt like a weirdo my entire life. I'm just a little bit different in so many ways from so many people around me. And so many people who read my book told me that my book helped them feel less alone, that they also felt weird, which made me think maybe everyone feels weird. Maybe it's just normal to feel weird. And everyone else, everyone who says they're normal, those people are fronting. Mm-hmm. But a few people who read my book who are on the autism spectrum asked me whether I had ever considered getting tested. And I have thought about it for a long time. And the other day, I actually started an evaluation with the Sachs Center in New York City. My evaluation was interrupted because the person evaluating me is in Israel and there were missiles raining down from Iran and he had to go to a bomb shelter. I mean, it's the headlines busting into, you know, my little bubble of a world. Mm. But in any case, I am pursuing a diagnosis because I have a really strong hunch that I'm at the probably the lower end of the autism spectrum. Yeah, I always feel different from everybody. And I think part of my collecting voices around subjects is me trying to feel less weird. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if we think about all of this, all the collecting of experiences you've had from Ulster, from people leaving New York, staying in New York, people who have read your memoir and also identify as weird, I imagine, but I'd love to hear from you, the sense of community you may or may not feel from those experiences. How do you feel any more in community as a result of collecting all these stories?
Very much. I think of myself as someone who creates community.
Yeah.
Literally and figuratively. I've done it many ways over the years. I started a writer's group when I moved upstate for a year in 2000. I had a writer's co-working space that I ran from 2017 to 2020 because I was missing writing community here mm-hmm. upstate. So I created a space that would foster community. I am very much about creating the community that doesn't exist for me.
Yeah.
When I need it and it doesn't exist, I make it.
Same.
It gets a little tiring. I had to close my co-working space for writers in April of 2020, mm-hmm. not surprisingly. Mm-hmm. I don't have the energy to start it again. For a while, I operated a Google group where I would get people together for drinks. You know, I'm ready for other people to make community that I can just join. But part of what I'm doing with these projects where I say, hey, what's your experience of leaving New York, of getting older? I am creating community for myself. Like, hey, I need some people around me who are also struggling with this. Hey, let's do this. And Ulster has really become a community. People comment. It is the most thoughtful comment section I have ever seen anywhere mm-hmm. and a very active comment section. People have befriended one another in there. Some people have gone on and met in real life. There are conversations within conversations, you know, nested in those comment threads. And it is so beautiful to me. And I feel like a part of the community and I'm grateful for it. So it's been really a wonderful thing to experience and witness.
And so this makes me think lastly of just if a writer is wanting to create that same feeling, like I can't be the only one. I can't be the only one who feels this way. as someone who's written two anthologies, has multiple Substacks, has written a memoir, et cetera, what advice might you have for someone who's trying to collect other people's stories and create that sense of community and communal storytelling?
You know, there are levels of this. You know, I'm professional. I've been a professional writer and editor for a very long time. So there are ways that I'm able to do this that aren't going to be as easily accessible to other people. But it can be as simple as starting a writer's group, posting on Facebook and saying, who wants to be in my writer's group? When I started my writer's group in Rhinebeck in 2000, I did it by, there was no Facebook. I posted a drawing of a typewriter, like the one on my arm, with a note saying writer's group forming, meet at this cafe at this hour, and people showed up. So anybody can do that. You know, you can post on Facebook and say, hey, who lives near me would like to join the writer's group I'm starting, or the book group I'm starting where we all read the same book and discuss it. You know, social media can be really useful in this way, or you can do like I did and post it, you know, post it at the health food store, post it at the library. Mm-hmm. There are so many ways these days to find community. There used to be these meetups or where people would post, hey, I'm going to have a meetup about science fiction and who wants to join me. It's a very viable way to meet new people and start a group. And not everybody stays in it. The ones who feel like they belong stay, and the ones who don't, don't. And I recommend that.
Well, I feel like from this conversation, the two threads that I've really pulled from it are follow your curiosities and put out the call. You know, it's like, okay, I'm curious about this. Is anyone else? Tell me. And those are the two key things.
Create a flash mob. Say, hey, let's all meet at this place and do it. Yeah, I agree with you. Yes, those are the threads.
So as we end here, though, I could talk all day. I love finding out from people something fun, which is what is bringing you joy these days?
The same thing that always brings me joy, which is singing, mm-hmm. which I do by myself almost every day. I sing karaoke using YouTube karaoke tracks. It just makes me feel so good. I also sing with my husband. I sing publicly at karaoke. So that, and also drawing with crayons. I love drawing with crayons. Even when I'm not drawing something I like, I love the feeling of dragging a crayon across paper. And I love the colors, and I'm bad at it, but I just love doing it.
This makes me so happy because for my last birthday, my 41st birthday, I asked all of my girlfriends to join me for a karaoke party. And when we arrived at the place where karaoke was supposed to be happening, they had rescheduled it, but the bar was still open. But oddly enough, one of my girlfriends in the birthday present had given me a microphone. And so we suddenly got the guy to turn on the TV. We pulled up YouTube karaoke lyrics. We had the microphone and we made our own party.
I love it. I have those mics. I've got two of them for duets.
All right, Sarah, if we ever meet in person, I will bring my karaoke microphone and we can have a karaoke party.
Let's do it. I love it.
Thank you so much for being on here today. I found it invaluable, so inspiring, and I can't wait for other people to listen.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to talk with you.
Didn't you just love this chat? I know I did. To find out more about both of us, we are both on Substack. You can let us know there what tidbits you took away from this that you really enjoyed. I'm so grateful to my podcast producer, Michelle Rado. And remember, everyone, every heart has a story, and every story has a heart. See you next time.